Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 18th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, and having just finished my scene-by-scene deep dive look at Act 2 through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations, today we're taking a look back at the act, but we'll also cover an adaptation we haven't touched yet. Hamlet as told by The Simpsons. Not my idea, it was Sean Ross's idea. So that's right. He's my very special guest to get through all this. Hi, Sean.
How's it going? I'm glad I could class the joint up a little bit by bringing a beloved animated version.
I think I was mostly remember this as short on research.
So there you go. See, I knew you'd watch the Branagh version and, you know, all these other versions. And I thought, well, what could I mention to Siskoid that'll only take him 10 minutes?
I am looking to, like in a future wrap up, to get a guest to watch the, there's a German expressionist silent film of Hamlet where Hamlet is played by a woman. It's on YouTube everything. So that's one I really want to check out. And I'm not touching it until, I'm not looking at it until I get a guest for it. But in this case, you know what? It's summer. Let's not get into too much work. And yet, I feel like any adaptation, even something as silly as The Simpsons, can spark new ideas about the staging, about what the play might mean or how the play might be played. So we'll get to talk about that, of course, as well as the great questions that face us in Act 2 of Hamlet. But first, look, we want to know what kind of Shakespeare fan you are, what kind of Hamlet fan you are. So, Sean, what is your experience with Shakespeare in general, and what does his work mean to you? I mean, you were pretty enthusiastic about guest starring on the show, so I imagine it's some part of your life.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. I shamelessly reached out to you. I think the minute you announced this show, I am a huge fan of Shakespeare, but Hamlet in particular just speaks to my soul. Like many people, you know, and I know Stello talked about this on the Act One wrap-up, you know, I first encountered Shakespeare in high school, you know, read Romeo and Juliet, and more importantly, watched the version where I got to see boobs in high school. And I don't remember who it was at, I'm trying to remember who directed that, the class.
That's the Zeffirelli one,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, Zeffirelli, that's right. And then I read Macbeth in high school and with a much better teacher, and we really delved into that. We watched the Polanski version of Macbeth, and I fell in love with the language and the story. I was an English major in college, and so I took, you know, my Shakespeare courses, and I had a wonderful Shakespeare professor who just opened up the whole world. And Hamlet in particular, I mean, I'm clearly not alone in this, Hamlet in particular really spoke to me as somebody who tended towards a softer masculinity, you know, somebody who liked poetry and words and, you know, wasn't so decisive and good with his fists. And, you know, I was much more a Hamlet than a Hamlet senior. And I just loved the work. And so I have a couple special attachments to it. One is my senior year of college, I was in a Victorian women's poetry class, which tells you everything you need to know about me, probably. And it was the first day of class, and we're reading a poem, and I think it's by Christina Rossetti. And there's a clear Hamlet reference in it. And so my professor's like, what are your thoughts on the poem? And I'm like, well, I think it's about this because there's this, you know, this, these three lines are clearly a reference to Hamlet. And I hear a kind of like, you know, deriding like kind of from behind. And I turn around and there's a woman behind me and she kind of like snarking at me. And I was like, okay, that's weird. So I go on in class and at the end of class, I turn around to her and I go, okay, did I offend you? What was that about? She's like, oh, you're such a nerd. Like, oh, look at this Hamlet reference. I've never met this one, by the way. She's like, you're such a nerd. Look at this Hamlet reference. And I go, it's not my fault. I'm educated and you're not. And she starts laughing and we start laughing. And 25 years later, we have been married for 23 years. And So my nerding out over Hamlet helped bring me and my wife together. So that has us always have a soft spot there. And then I was a classroom teacher. I'm still an educator, but I was a classroom teacher for 15 years. And for the first 7 years of my career, I taught a classical curriculum that started with Greek mythology, went to the Iliad, Antigone, to Dante's Inferno, Hamlet, and then Paradise Lost. And so, you know, trying to convince 15 and 16-year-olds that these are worth reading is tough, but I apparently did a good job selling it because my kids loved the class, and Hamlet in particular was their favorite work, and they loved it. And so just has always been a part of my life, and I just have always had a soft spot for it. But, you know, brought me my wife. It was one of the first great works I got to teach as a teacher. And so I was super excited when you started the show, and I could listen. I mean, your analysis of it is brilliant, and I'm just enjoying it more than I can tell you.
You were luckier than I was. I was also in a relationship with a lit person for a relatively short time. And she called me Hamlet, and I called her the Bovary. It was like each of our fetish works. It didn't work out.
Well, I'm glad you didn't call her Ophelia. I was waiting on the nickname for her. I was like, there's not really going to be a good nickname from Hamlet.
No. She had her own work, so she was Emma Bovary, and I was Hamlet. No, I would never call anyone Ophelia because she's a suicide, and every time somebody calls their kid Ophelia, and I realize they're taking it from, in French anyway, Ophélie, there's Ophélie Winter, who's a famous pop singer. Mm-hmm. So they're taking it from that, but I'm always like, you can't name your kid after, like, that name does not exist in the English, in any language, until Shakespeare puts it on paper as Ophelia. There are no Ophelias mm-hmm. other than Ophelia until Ophelia. So naming your kid after that, it's like, are you going to kill you? Are you going to kill your kid? Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's like people who play Every Breath You Take by the Police at their wedding. It's just, you're not getting the message.
It's nice that Shakespearean names are still current and people are using them, but it's a little weird. And people say, well, wouldn't you call your kid Hamlet? And I was
like, no.
No.
Yeah, no, not at all.
If I call my kid anything from Shakespeare, it's going to be a comedy.
Yeah, exactly. I may throw a Horatio in there, but that's as close as I'm going to get.
Right. Somebody, I know someone who did call their kid Horatio, I think. So there's someone, you know, parallel to us in the podcast sphere who did that.
That's funny. I have to tell you, in teaching Hamlet over the years, one of my favorite memories is I had a student named Megan. And Megan, in the middle, we're reading Hamlet, and I had the kids to get into the Shakespeare of it all, we performed it. They would perform each act, and then we would sit and analyze, and you know, and really in an interactive fashion. And then we would watch little snippets. And this student Megan I had, who was this very prim and proper straight A student, who you know couldn't even dream of disrupting class. In the middle of the end of the play, you know, the flights of angels, you know, sing thee to thy rest, she stands up and she goes, I'm in love with Horatio, and then just sits down. And I was like, wait, what just happened? And she's like, I've been holding it in the whole play, and I have to admit it, I'm in love. And I'm like, oh, do you have your first literary crush? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm so proud. So I always think fondly of Horatio, and I hope that Megan eventually found her Horatio.
That's cute. Do you have favorite plays?
Yeah, I mean, Hamlet, you know, is obviously, you know, my favorite. And the thing I used to tell my students all the time was that, you know, the brilliance of Hamlet is that every word carries five meanings. You know, every line has five meanings. It's so pliable, and it depends on the lens with which you read it. And that's what makes it wonderful to reread every year and teach every year and you see what they're going to bring to it. So Hamlet is absolutely my favorite. But I also love A Comedy of Errors, just the sheer goofy quirkiness of it. You know, I love Much Ado About Nothing. You know, so I'm a big fan of the comedies. My favorite two other than Hamlet are probably Henry IV, Part II, and then Henry V. The Henry trilogy. I love Falstaff, and I love the evolution of Hal, you know, from where he starts as this, you know, lovable, bumbling prince to, you know, the Agincourt, you know, speech. And so, it's definitely, I'm really moved by those works, and I have such a deep love for them. And I was really proud of the fact that, you know, for a good portion of my career, I got to pass on the love of Shakespeare to you know, new generation.
Let's talk about Hamlet specifically. Do you have a favorite adaptation?
I do. So I, as a teacher, so I started teaching in 2000, knowing I was going to teach this classical course, this classical curriculum, and knowing what an uphill battle that was going to be. Because I had just everyday students, you know, normal kids, and I knew this was going to be a battle. I would always look for modern connections, and I would look for how can I make this relevant to their lives? What can I find in their lives, you know, that will remind them of Daphne and Apollo, or, you know, will remind them of, you know, Antigone and making a choice like that. And so for Hamlet, I was very fortunate because the Ethan Hawke version came out right when I was starting to teach. And so even though I loved the Branagh version, you know, I knew it wasn't going to necessarily sing for that, for a generation of kids. Whereas Ethan Hawke, you know, Julia Stiles is in it, and the Steve Zahn is in it, and, you know, it's just got a great cast, and, you know, Bill Murray's my favorite Polonius of all time. And so I used to show that version, and now I would show snippets, you know, this is pre-YouTube, so it was hard to find, but I would show kind of snippets of different versions. And of, you know, of course they hated Olivier. They thought it was incredibly boring. And even Branagh, they were like, oh yeah, you know, I kind of get it. That's a girl from Titanic. But the Ethan Hawke version really sung for them. And in particular, I think it did such a good job of presenting a sort of multifaceted Polonius. Like, I always think of that scene where he's tying Ophelia's shoes, you know, while he's chastising her, you know, the tender yourself more dearly or you'll tender me a fool. And he's just tying her shoes really tightly. And it's both loving and incredibly horrible and pedantic. And I think that version, while super not problematic by the modern sense of the word, but just as a Hamlet fan, takes some big swings that, you know, in retrospect are kind of funny. Like, you know, being in a Blockbuster during the to be or not to be speech, you know, is maybe not everybody's cup of tea. I love it. I love Ethan Hawke as slacker Hamlet. And it really is still to this day a beloved version for me. I know, and I love that you cover it on your show. In fact, had you not been covering it, it would have been the adaptation I would have, you know, really wanted to dive into today. But when you were like, well, you know, I do already cover that in depth. What's another version? In wrapping up Hamlet, Hamlet was always the last unit of the year in that course. I would show the kids that full Simpsons episode of the great classics, because they cover the Odyssey. So they do the first part of the Odyssey, which is, you know, the Trojan horse piece. So it connected to reading the Iliad. And then they did Hamlet. And the kids would die laughing, particularly Lisa as Ophelia. And it resonated so much for them, and they found it so funny and but in a witty way, in a way where they understood the source material and they understood the humor, the depth of what The Simpsons was pointing out in some places. And so that's why I was like, oh yeah, I've got to bring that version. So the Ethan Hawke version will always be my favorite, but I'm glad we're going to talk about the silly version today.
Of course, it's part of my canon as well, because it's one of the major ones, ones easily available on DVD, etc. I have others, you know, that I don't cover on the show, which are stage plays, you know, like film stage plays, that kind of thing. But I felt like, well, that's harder for listeners to track down.
Yeah.
They might not have seen it because it's like the Kevin Kline performance, or, you know, it's interesting things to say about them, you know, but I tried to stick to, because I do that Alexander Fodor one, which is completely experimental. No one's seen this except me, but still, I feel like, okay, well, that brings out such different elements that I have to cover it as well.
Even the gender switching in that version, you know, is so interesting. And I really, we're due a version, right? About every 10 years or something. So I'm waiting for the announcement that Timothy Chalamet, you know, is going to be Hamlet, and, you know, it must be coming soon, right? So, you know, one version I would just recommend, either, I don't know if it's something you've read or if you're going to get to, but do you know Ryan North? He's a comic book writer.
Sure.
And he wrote Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, which is a great book. And he's actually currently writing The Fantastic Four, which is a phenomenal run. But he did a graphic novel version called To Be or Not to Be, which is a choose-your-own-adventure Hamlet.
Oh, yeah, I have that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So yeah. That's a fun. I know you talk about the Tom Mandrake version, but the Ryan North version is really fun.
At some point, I also want to do something like comic book versions, but all thrown together. Things like Kill Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. For example, it's like there are some connecting tissues there that might be fun to one day cover. I thought there was already a, you know, like a more recent Hamlet on Amazon Prime or something. I'm trying to find it here, but while we're talking, but I'm not sure which it is. There's so many Hamlets that when you search for them, it's like, well, here's a list of 100 films called Hamlet, you know?
Well, and I'm glad we're starting to see the rise, and not starting as in recently, it's been for a while, but the rise of, you know, Ophelia's perspective, you know, and some film versions of that as well.
Two of the most difficult characters in the play are Ophelia and Gertrude. Mm-hmm. Like, the female perspective is underrepresented within the text, which is a very rare thing for Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Shakespeare wrote a lot of very full, rich, complex heroines. And then you get to Hamlet, and it's like, oh, these are really underwritten roles compared to.
When, you know, and the frailty of that name is a woman, you know, it kind of compounds it. But it's funny, when I used Hamlet in my classroom, one of the projects I would assign my kids is they had to write soliloquies for characters who do not get their own. And so they could pick, you know, anybody. And so I'd get Horatio and Rosencrantz, but a lot of Gertrude soliloquies and a lot of Ophelia soliloquies. And let me tell you, telling a 15 or 16 year old girl, especially, hey, delve into that character. And what does she have to say? Like, what do we not hear from Ophelia? That was always one of my favorite projects to do, because those soliloquies those kids would put together were just impactful and powerful. And it showed as much about them as it did about Ophelia, but it really showed how elements of Ophelia resonated with them even today, you know, that feeling of, you know, in a way being controlled by others, and especially when you're 15 or 16, and that feeling of falling too quickly under the sway of first love. And it was always one of my favorite moments, because they shed light on Ophelia in a way that I, you know, just wasn't going to see on my own.
Wow. Oh, that sounds super interesting. All right. Well, let's dive into Act Two. The big questions. I just did 7 episodes about it, or however many it was. Some questions kept recurring. They call Hamlet a problem play because it's got problems for the directors and for the actors, mm-hmm. choices to make, right? So if we start from the beginning, which is the Rinaldo scene, which they often cut Rinaldo scene, and the whole idea of Rinaldo spying on Laertes in France. Why do we need this? That's my question to you, Sean. Why is this in the play?
I think it's such an important moment for Polonius, because one of the questions of Hamlet, the brilliance of this play is that, you know, there's so many different ways to read the characters. And is Polonius, you know, this very conniving vizier pulling strings behind the scenes, or is he a bumbling fool? You know, is he somewhere in between? Does he love his children? You know, the implication, he's raised them on his own in a way. You know, it seems like the mother maybe died in childbirth with Ophelia. We don't really know. But the way you see Polonius in my mind hinges, most people hinge it on the, you know, brevity is the soul of wit, or, you know, some of the other scenes. But for me, a lot of it comes from this scene, because it's self-generated. This isn't Polonius trying to impress Claudius and Gertrude. This isn't Polonius trying to insinuate his daughter into the life of the royals. This is just him, about him and his son. The audacity of, you know, convincing yourself you have this big idea that is on, you know, when you scratch the surface is the dumbest thing ever, to go to France and say, hey, is Laertes really still into prostitutes and gambling and, you know, drugs, and is he still, you know, like, will he still kill a man just to watch him die and then see what people say? And it's like, my kids always responded in such a funny way, because they're like, wait, does he not understand he would be starting the very rumors that he would be, the confirmation would eventually come back around like a game of telephone? And I'm like, no, he doesn't understand that. And that's what makes Polonius such an interesting character. And it's funny, because my current job has a bit of a political bent to it. And I encounter a lot of Poloniuses at times, people who, you know, will talk and they're super high on their own supply, and they have this great big idea. And then you start asking just really fundamental, basic questions about it, and it all falls apart. And so for me, this is the confirmation that Polonius is, you know, a blowhard. Now, he doesn't mean he's not conniving or sinister or dangerous, but I need this scene to help steer my view of him. I mean, do you get a lot from him in this moment?
Of all the scenes that get cut, this to me is the most damaging, mm-hmm. because I very often will look at an adaptation, and if this scene is not in it, that is a much weaker Polonius and therefore a much weaker play.
Yeah.
So when it is included, suddenly there are two characters. I would say there are two characters in the play that if you cut certain moments or play them in a certain way, it's very easy to make them two-dimensional, whereas the writing doesn't make them two-dimensional. And those are the two villains, really, mm-hmm. Polonius and Claudius. Claudius can very well come off as a two-dimensional, mustache-twirling villain. But when you get into, well, does he actually, what if he actually loves Gertrude? Yeah. What if he's actually kind of a benevolent king? What if we're thinking that maybe the ghost or like Hamlet Sr. wasn't so benevolent, wasn't such a great king, but he still murdered him. So he's the villain, but maybe there's some redeeming values that makes him so much richer. And I think like the Brana version, certainly because it is the entire text, restores that in Claudius, whereas you don't see it in Olivier's, for example. And then Polonius, similarly, can so easily come off as foolish, the bumbling old man, mm-hmm. the, you know, he's just doddering. But, I mean, in the play, he's a major agent of the things that happen. A lot of it is his fault.
Yeah.
And if you play him as having a sinister streak, he's controlling to his kids. We see how far he goes here with Laertes. We saw a little bit how it went with Ophelia and, you know, saying that she can't see Hamlet and so on. He's manipulating her, and that's obvious. But remove this scene, it's like he's not sinister enough mm-hmm. to merit his death.
And I love that you went there, because that's where I land as well. If you don't have this moment, then Hamlet has committed murder. Not that he hasn't still committed murder, but he's murdered somebody who is not maybe somebody you relate to or have affection for, but it's somebody who's just ignorant. Like what he's done is more sinful. It's harder to justify. Whereas when you have this scene, you can say like, well, Polonius is a villain, and his own villainous rumor mongering and eavesdropping and his machinations led to his death as much as anything. So I do think this is such an important moment. And then I also love the contrast in this moment of Laertes loves his father. You know, Laertes and Ophelia love their father, and Laertes believes his father to be this really good man, and, you know, comes storming into the castle later for vengeance. Well, Hamlet believes the same thing about Hamlet Sr. And we get this snapshot that Laertes is very wrong about his own father. And we are often wrong about our own parents in some ways. And you know, is Hamlet is wrong? You know, you've talked a lot in the show about doubling or mirroring. And so is Hamlet just as wrong? You know, did he not see the faults in Hamlet Sr.? Was Hamlet Sr. away at war and, you know, so many victories that it was just Hamlet Sr. is more of a painting or a you know, portrait in Hamlet's mind than a real person? And so that, I think, also calls – fathers are always called into question in this play. And so this is an important moment of Shakespeare saying, like, sons don't ever really understand their fathers. And so that you can't help but have that lean over to Hamlet as well.
And there's a special irony in the technique that Polonius uses. You know, let's spread some rumors. We'll just mention some rumors to see if others bite. And then Hamlet's kind of going to do the same to Claudius. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of things that are working together. If you remove one part, and I understand that the play is 3.5-4 hours, but if you remove one piece like this, you lose something. And that's always been my contention when it comes to removed scenes, whether it's the history of Denmark, whether it's this, whether it's the players, which are also coming up in this act. When you remove this stuff, it's in there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And taking it away kind of simplifies things. And I do believe we lose something. Also part of the scene is Ophelia walking in. Hamlet has just visited her in her closet. They're very small rooms in Elizabethan theater. And she tells us, this is like the first hint of the first way that Hamlet shows his madness, it depends what really happened. Since we're getting it secondhand, what do you think actually, or what is the best way to think of what really happened?
This is such a pivotal moment for me in the way I evaluate Hamlet as a character, the way he treats Ophelia. And I can't help but go back to my students, because, you know, you get to the, you know, get thee to a nunnery moment. And my students would always be like, you know, yeah, he's being really mean to her, but, you know, she betrayed him and she betrayed their love. And he wrote that, you know, pretty beautiful poem to her. And I would always remind them, hey, she's like 14, you know, first of all, she's really young. I'm like, and secondly, did she betray him first? Because, you know, he goes to her closet and, you know, affrights her, and his pants are down around his ankles. I mean, just the bodiness of it. He doesn't have a cap on, and he's, you know, walking backwards, spooking her. And I always wonder in this moment, Could he have made a different choice? Could he have let her in on the plot? Could he have said to her, trusted her, and said, hey, I'm going to feign madness? Because I do believe in the beginning he's faking it, and then I do believe he goes mad for a bit. But, you know,
okay.
I'm going to feign madness, and I need your support on that. I need you to help me with it. But it's only pretense for me to discover a truth I'm looking for. You know, and again, it's a big secret to let her in on, and she's a young girl. And it's a valid question to ask, can he trust, not so much trust her integrity, but trust her willingness to disobey her father or the king if asked a direct question? You know, he'd be putting her in some danger, really. So I always kind of wonder that. But in my mind, he betrays her first. And this scene, you know, she's a young girl and she's hearing from her trusted father and father figure, you know, in Claudius, you know, the king, and mother figure in Gertrude. She's never had a mother, you know, and so she's hearing from Laertes, you know, she's hearing from everybody, don't trust Hamlet. And then instead of debunking that, you know, he comes to her and in a way that can't be interpreted as anything but having an undercurrent of sexual threat to it, you know, which goes to the question of whether they've slept together or not. But there's, you know, there's a bit of a sexual undertone there and, you know, kind of drives her immediately to her father. So the very thing he suspected she would do, he sort of causes her to do. So I think he's a real piece of crap in this moment. Like I think she's telling the truth. I think he's playing her the way everybody else is. And I think he's more horrible for it because he loves her. If had he played this differently, who knows how it might have turned out. But this is a dark scene for me, for Hamlet. It really turns me away from him as any sort of moral character.
Okay, so you don't think it is sincere, like her interpretation is sincere from her, but that he was sincere in that moment, that because there is one way to play it. You're not supposed to see it, right? But some movies will show it, yeah. And of course. But the one way to interpret it is that, like, he knows that this mission would put her in danger, would put himself in danger. He has to cut off all ties because he's going to restrain himself from going as far as he wants to go if he's thinking about his, you know, romantic interest. So he cuts off ties with her. So going there, and then you're not sure how to interpret his demeanor, like you say. I mean, is he going there for one last booty call and and then snaps? You know, what's happening exactly? But does he go to her to break things off, but also he feels like he's leaving something behind? This is the sacrifice that he makes.
Yeah.
And in that moment, there is a sort of madness. A sort of emotional turmoil, making sense of that scene where it's already pretty odd that Hamlet has no words. He doesn't say anything. She doesn't relate dialogue. It's not like him. In other words, yes, it could be a put on, or is it a full psychotic break at that moment? Is it saying goodbye, not only to her, but to his courtly life of somewhat comfort within his depression, but comfort?
The only thing that gives me pause about this being kind of a noble sacrifice on his part of like cutting Ophelia off because of the danger his actions will eventually maybe put her in is when she comes to him. I have correspondences I've longed to redeliver, and he freaks out on her. You know, so if it was about cutting her off, he should have played that moment differently. Like, oh, I mean, I know he knows he's being watched, but you know, that moment maybe would have been different of like, oh, good, she's excised herself from my life as well. Like, well, you know, she's safe now and I can always come back and explain later, hopefully, if things go differently. But, and then is it real madness? I just feel like the way it expresses itself, you know, in my mind, he's such a man of words. He's such a man of language, like you said, that, you know, were he really going to her for sort of comfort and maybe on the brink of madness, he would have maybe found words for her. And maybe he does and she doesn't relay them. But the pageantry of it, the sort of, I don't know, like harlequin nature of, you know, the way his clothes are messed up and everything, it does feel like pretense to me. It does feel like his first staging of his madness, you know, or not first, but, you know, one of the early stagings of it, which, again, makes me really, really angry at him.
I mean, it's legitimate to think that in Act Two, it's all a put on. Mm-hmm. You know, the way he feigns madness to Polonius and then to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, all the stooges, and like he has asides that are lucid.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing it for comedy a lot of the time. So it's not true madness. This is the feigned madness that he says he's going to feign. But at the same time, there is a sort of break there that's like he's hiding true mental health issues with the madcap, you know, attitude.
I definitely think he goes mad. I definitely think that he stares into the abyss and it stares back. Like, I think it's a very viable read to say he's feigning madness, but the weight of all of this, you know, the death, the marriage, the ghost, heaven and hell, like the weight of everything he's managing causes him to seek solace in the only place he can, because he can't go to his mom anymore. And, you know, he can't go to his dad. And, you know, Horatio is a good friend, but I don't know that that's, you know, he's looking for a sort of a kind of love that Ophelia could give, a kind of solace. And so maybe it is a complete breakdown. Maybe, you know, seeing her and knowing that that solace can't be there for him is, you know, maybe this is the first real peek into it. So, you know, again, the beauty of the play is how you read that moment. Like I said, because it's an early part of the play and I feel like he's still staging more than anything, I do read it as feigned, but very viable that this is the, you know, one of the first cracks in the armor.
You could have a more sinister Hamlet even than that, mm-hmm. where the poetry is also written specifically to raise flags. Like he knows that poetry is going to wind up in Polonius's hands and then into the royal's hands. And you can read that little piece of poetry as somewhat manipulative as well, you know? So there's a lot that if you want to play Hamlet as more of a villain, mm-hmm. more ruthless, more cruel than as necessarily written, you could actually do that.
Yeah, and it's funny because I don't see him as cruel as much as careless. And, you know, the scene when he and Laertes are literally fighting on her grave, like I just think they're so careless with her, you know, the result is tragic. And so I just see this as more carelessness on his part. But this would be a fun adaptation of him just really being depicted as truly a real diagnosis, right? Potentially being bipolar, you know, whatever the diagnosis may be, like really playing it as to see that if that really is what he's struggling with and all of this is coming from a somewhat honest place, you know, without the asides, it changes the play dramatic. It'd be a fun way to see it.
I think so too, because madness is a tragedy trope. But madness in the Elizabethan sense or, you know, wherever you go into literature, madness... that's not a diagnosis. I mean, it's not real. It's not real psychology. So if you apply what we know of actual psychology today, psychology and psychiatry, you could reinterpret these characters in the modern way. And all you need in a movie version is for him to, you know, take medication at some point or stop taking medication. Mm-hmm. And that's a silent scene. And that would maybe guide you through the emotional up and downs. I could see it. Maybe it's been done as well. Like I said, 100 Hamlets, you know.
Kevin Kline does it in Soap Dish where he does his one-man Hamlet because it's all in his head.
Okay.
That's the only version I think that got close.
Yeah, his stage play doesn't do that. It's like a semi-modern, but it doesn't do that. Act Two introduces us to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. One of the big questions of the play, I think, is RNG, actual friends or... are the parents misled on this point?
I think, and this is funny, this is something that my students led me to think of more than anything. They're his party friends. You have friends that you have go with you to your father's funeral, and you have friends that you go out with on a Friday night, right? And so I think they're his indiscreet party friends, and he's talked a lot about them because he's had a lot of fun with them. I mean, he's lived a relatively privileged life. And they're his buddies. And so I think it's the wrong call on the part of the king and queen to bring them in specifically because they don't have access to Hamlet emotionally. They're the take him out, get him drunk, get him laid friends, which I guess from the king and queen's perspective may make sense. They may be like, he maybe just needs to get out and have some fun. But definitely, I don't think his parents are misled as much as when you're a kid, you tell your, I mean, I see this with my own kid, you know, she'll tell me about her friends and if you asked me who her best friend is, I would say one kid. And then 5 weeks later, I'd say that to her and she'd be like, no, it's not. It's so-and-so. And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't realize things had changed. And, you know, I do think that they're just college party friends and they're both destined to be divorced 3 times if they don't die. You know, Hamlet's going to have to move them out into progressively smaller apartments as they each failed marriage. You know, Hamlet's going to be the reliable friend and not a mistake, but definitely not the answer they were hoping for.
That's certainly the interpretation in Hamlet 2000, right?
Yeah.
Specifically, when they get there, it's like to the bar immediately to have our scenes. Definitely what the director was thinking of them there. Obviously, there are different interpretations, and we talked about them on the show as well. And some of them are about class. The two sides of this, the other one is Horatio. And Horatio is the confidant. But also, Horatio, the way he speaks, like, you know, I'm a stranger here. I'm not of Elsinore. You know, I'm a college friend, but probably from another place, from another town or another, even another kingdom. Elsinore is not my place. I'm not a courtly character. Mm-hmm. And maybe Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are. They're part of the court, so the king and queen go to them. And I bring this up because I brought this up a lot on the show. Where is Horatio in all this? You know, once Horatio is told at the end of Act 1, Hamlet tells him, you know, swear on the sword and all of this. He then mostly disappears. Mm-hmm. You know, he's there at the play. He's present in Act 2 when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are finishing up. When the players show up, Horatio is present. But he's largely silent. So some people have said that if not for the soldiers, Horatio that really doesn't talk to anyone except Hamlet. Is he then real?
I think it'd be a valid reading. I always see Horatio as, I mean, this is no great jump. You know, he's Hamlet's conscience in a way. Like, things have to be verified by Horatio before Hamlet will really believe them. Like, you know, did you really see the ghost? And then after the play, you know, did you see Horatio? Did you see his look? Did you see his countenance about Claudius? That's the most telling thing about Horatio, is that when Hamlet doesn't trust himself, he trusts Horatio. You know, Hamlet doesn't trust himself in this play, nor should he. And I do think there is an element at the time, you know, the play is written and staged, I think there is a commentary on the courtly class, because everybody involved in the court wants something, is driven by their own sort of internal nature and their own quest for power. You know, does Gertrude love Claudius, or does she marry him so she's not a queen awaiting a king to take over? You know, Claudius clearly wants the throne, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern want to be in their good graces, and, you know, Polonius works his way up to be the vizier, and everybody in this play wants something from the court or wants more power. And Horatio's really the only voice of stability and that, you know, isn't driven by desires and passions. And so it's interesting that he's so underrepresented, right? Because this is a play about passions. It's almost like he's the mini eye of the hurricane, and he has to be there to remind you that you're in a hurricane, or, you know. So I do think his role is really vital. I think the idea of him being in Hamlet's head is fascinating, and I love that idea. I don't think he has any time for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I think he sizes them up immediately, knows who and what they are. Hamlet knows immediately why they're there. So Horatio's not overly worried about them having any sort of undue influence. And he feels okay just, you know, leaving them to it.
I can't believe that some adaptations cut out Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Well, I can believe it in the sense that Polonius is already a spy, kind of sounding Hamlet, and they are too. So it's like they're doubling up, tripling up on the same function in the play, even though they come at it from a different perspective. Let's try everything to get at Hamlet's truth. Already, it's like two characters who could just be one character. So a lot of people have made jokes about it, obviously, and it leads us to Tom Stoppard's.
Yeah.
You know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, and which I would also like to do in one of these wrap-ups, you know.
Oh, I hope you do, yeah.
For sure. But it's like they become like this big Shakespearean joke, and you're almost thinking, well, was there like an extra cast member who needed work?
I think it's the closing off of all the doors for Hamlet. It's, you know, his father's dead and Gertrude remarries, so family's not there. Ophelia's not to be trusted because of her father, so love isn't there. The ghost could be from the devil, so God isn't there. And now Rosencrantz and Guildenstern turn, so friends aren't there. It's this shutting of every door by Shakespeare, so that Hamlet is, in all intents and purposes, completely alone and left to his own devices, which explains the spin a little more, right? Because I think for a lot of people who watch or read Hamlet, and my students used to get really frustrated. It's funny, their reaction to Hamlet told you a lot about who they were as people, because a lot of my boys in particular would be like, I don't get it. I would have seen the ghost, grab a sword, killed him. Like, we're done. And I'm like, yeah, so Laertes would have too. And look where that goes. And you know, and so I do think it's Shakespeare systematically boxing Hamlet in more and more and more, so that he's left with only himself is the sounding board. Though, you know, again, Horatio plays that role at times. It just makes the play feel more claustrophobic and gives him even less places to turn, which I really love. I love, of course, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have taken on this whole other element because of the Stoppard play, you know, and the movie, which is brilliant. But I definitely love the interaction with them, because Hamlet, you know, even though he knows why they're there, he peeks out again for a second, you know, with the Quintessence of Dust speech to see, is there something there still for us? And then realizes, oh, very quickly, no. And, you know, shuts back down immediately. So, like, he's so hopeful. He so wants any sort of conduit. any sort of support system, and they just shut down one by one around him. So I think that part's really important, and that resonated a lot for my students, who's, you know, in high school, your life is your friends. They all talked a lot about like having been betrayed by a friend and what that does to you. So I think it's such an important scene.
Back to back, his mad scene with Polonius, his mad scene with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, because it provides so much comedy. You know, where not only is it, are both conversations funny, but they're also Hamlet being Bugs Bunny, or, you know, it's Hamlet is cleverly, wittily playing, you know, rhetorical circles around these guys, all three of them. And there's a joy to that. At this point, you just think this is a revenge story. And in the revenge story, the witty hero is kind of finding out who he can trust and kind of mocking the ones that he knows he can't. So there's a lot of, you know, fun to be had there. This is the lighter part of the play.
It is, and it's fun to see Hamlet in that role as this smart, witty, you know, very good with language and outsmarting everybody around him. And yet he can't help but lose the grip every, like, you know, accept my life. Like, I don't think he meant for that to come out with Polonius. And then the man delights not me. I don't think he meant for that to come out in front of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, and again, the funny comic moment, like nor woman neither, you know, they're kind of ball busting, which is something friends would do, but that's where you can see the melancholy and madness creeping in out of his control. And that, so that's the other thing I think is so brilliant about these moments is he's playing them, but he's not fully in control.
And he's going to try to take control because now he knows who his enemies are. Mm-hmm. I think we've introduced them all, but suddenly possible allies, the players. This is also a scene that gets not entirely cut, but you know, like this, the first player speech very often gets cut. Because it is, well, it's so long that Polonius says this is too long.
That's such a great moment.
I love that bit. And he's just had his own, I mean, ironically, in the same act, he was telling the king and queen that he would be brief, mm-hmm. and then he goes on and on and on and on and on, you know? So again, we'll always have this with Polonius. He says one thing, but he does something else, and he's never quite... You know, ironically, he's never aware of his hypocrisy or, you know, that this is why he's foolish. He doesn't understand who he is. Mm-hmm. And the play, and you just said it, Hamlet is left to his own devices, cut off from everyone, almost everyone. He's using himself as a sounding board, which is the perfect Shakespearean technique of the character overhearing themselves and then able to change based on what they've learned mm-hmm. of themselves in their own speech, which was an innovation at the time because in Elizabethan theater, that did not exist. People were a type and they were that type all the way through. And that's where Shakespeare sort of took off away from Marlowe, who would have been the premier playwright at the time, and then took us off into a more modern view of the character. The fact that Hamlet is forced to soliloquize and forced to speak to himself because no one else can understand his drama, according to him, but also no one else can be trusted with these thoughts. When he sees the players, that scene goes on too long. And the play itself, Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, goes on too long. It's going on too long already based on this. And Shakespeare is making fun of length through Polonius and like comments like that one. This is too long. He's also talking about Hamlet, Prince of Denmark as staged, you know, at this moment. So he knows, but it's because Hamlet is learning about himself throughout the play and learning what kind of man he is. And if he is a man who can murder mm-hmm. or avenge, you know, like he has to learn this. He wasn't born an avenger. He has to become one or be forced to become one. And he has to process it with words. And the players are sort of kind of doing this work for him in a way.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting because Hamlet has to see an example before he can do something. Like he can't generate it on his own. Being fascinated by acting as a character and fascinated by words and language and sort of the manipulation of emotions, he's then also amazed at his own ability to be manipulated by the Hecuba speech and the actor's tears. And it's pretty funny because it's a little bit shallow on his part where it's like he couldn't access what he needed on his own. He had to sort of watch somebody else play at it before he could do it, and then even kind of took that route. It's like he's much more Claudius' son than Hamlet's, I have to say. Like I think that on the spectrum of character types, he and Claudius and Polonius are all of a type. They're all on the same spectrum. They're all people who use or think they use logic and words to disarm, and they find their strength in manipulation and in outsmarting and outreasoning people. And that's definitely not who his father was, you know, as we see. And so I think that for me, that's always the irony, is that the very thing he uses to unpack his heart with words is the very thing Claudius used to unpack his mother's heart, and the very thing, you know, Claudius used to unpack the kingdom's heart. And I think it's that inability to see himself in Claudius is also one of the big failings, because at the end of the day, I don't think he'd be any better king than Claudius is.
Well, probably not, you know? If this leads us down to the, you know, people who theorize that perhaps Claudius is the biological father.
Yeah.
Kind of fits the facts. And then when you describe it that way, it's like, oh, yeah, it's, you know? But there are a lot of characters in here. It's not just Polonius, who don't realize what they are about.
Mm-hmm.
They think they know themselves, but they don't know themselves. Not yet. And the play will hopefully expose who they really are. There's a lot of theater talk in this. There's the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are talking about how the tragedians of the city, and they are out of favor, and there's like these new stage stars who are terrible actors. And then we see an actual speech in action and how it affects Hamlet. And then later, before the mousetrap, we do get Hamlet telling actors how to act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gives little lessons. This is like inside baseball becomes meta, where actors playing characters telling us about how acting works. Pretty interesting. And people who are in drama studying to be actors, like my podcasting partner Bass, has a degree in dramatic arts, and they made them not learn these speeches, but study these speeches to show, you know, look how theater was, you know, what was Shakespeare's ideas about theater and how theater evolved from there, from the Elizabethan era to today, and how modern he was really in the things that he says you shouldn't do. So that's all part of it as well. I guess it's all part of Hamlet deciding, I'm going to play a character. You know, I'm going to play the mad character. And so the actor and the character all become kind of confused in the play.
Yeah, and that's definitely at play. And I also think the further brilliance of this play is he's writing the manual for how to and not to play Hamlet in the very play itself, because this is a play that lends itself to real pitfalls for actors. Like, you can really ham it up and really destroy your performance and your sincerity if you don't pick your battles and you don't pick your moments well. And we've seen that, right? Like, we've seen some Hamlets that, you know, maybe aren't as successful as others, or, you know, aren't as sort of nuanced as others. And it definitely, I love the fact that Shakespeare is like, look, this is a really hard role. I'm, you know, it's so hard that I'm not going to have time to train you to do it well. So I'm just going to build it into the play itself. And I think that's really funny.
Although he was present, I mean, in his own theater.
he was, but I think it's a really funny moment for him, you know, and I've always loved that meta sort of tongue-in-cheek moment of him to be like, you know, Hamlet saying like, I've encountered actors who couldn't even act as humans, and in preparing for this episode, you know, I was watching a bunch of Hamlet versions, and definitely some are more successful than others. There was a recent one. I'm blanking on the actor's name. He played the priest at Fleabag season 2.
Sure, yeah.
He did a version of it, and it didn't connect with me because he was really going for it in every line, and I was like,
Andrew Scott,
yeah. And Andrew Scott's a really good actor, so I'm not disparaging him, but he's really going for it, and every line is really important to him, and is carrying a lot of weight, and he just can't sustain that as, you know, as an audience. It just doesn't connect as much. So I was laughing because I was like, oh, he didn't take Shakespeare's advice from the play.
Yeah, you can easily get strident with it, or any of these parts, right? Because it's so heightened. I think Shakespeare was probably reacting to other theaters. You know, there's like a hit piece to other playwrights, other actors and directors in the middle of his play, but possibly reacting to what other theaters were popular. And it's like, well, we're doing what we think is high art, but there's like these crappy summer plays, you know, I mean, they've always existed, where it's just clowning around and there's a lot of breaking the fourth wall and bad improv mixed in, you know, that exists today.
Oh,
and
sure.
I'm sure it existed back then.
Well, and you know, the only thing less subtle would have Shakespeare had added a line where Hamlet says, "A mar high, not mar low." And then, you know, the full shot would have been delivered.
It's interesting for a playwright to do this sort of thing because they're more limited in, you know, in a novel. You could easily put your opinions about
sure.
writing or anything, you know, as part of, it could be your narrator, it could be your characters discussing things. You could put your messaging in there. But with a play, it's a shorter form and there's less room for that. Well, Shakespeare found a way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll have to get back to this because The Mousetrap, etc. will cover this as well. Mm-hmm. But speaking of The Mousetrap, this is my last big question about the act. When does Hamlet think up the plan? It seems to happen at the end of Act Two. And yet, could it be earlier? Could it be during the player's speech? And then he's just explaining it to us later. Because when he's with the players, he says, "I'll have you do a play tonight. We'll have a play and it'll be, can you learn? Can you input some lines in there?" And then later seems to have the revelation that he'll catch the conscience of the king with the play. So when does it actually happen?
I think it's playing in the back of his brain. I think there's like an itch in the back of his mind as he's watching the players. And the addition of lines is more maybe a chance to express himself or grief for his father's passing or celebrate his father. I think it's more of a Hamlet indulging in what he knows he's good at, right? He knows he's a good writer or wordsmith. He knows he's a good actor. I mean, he delivers the first half of the Hecuba speech. You know, and really leaning into where he shines in a way because he hasn't felt good about himself in a while. And so I think it's in the back of his brain of like, oh, I love this. I love this world. I want to interact with this world. And then when he's so caught off guard by the player delivering the Hecuba speech and is so overcome that he really spins out of control, you know, screaming at the air and calling himself a coward and a whore. And I do think it's that idea of, well, wait, this is the area where I shine. And if I could get played like this by the player, if I could react this way, then surely I could get the king too as well. So I do think it forms over the course of that entire arc, but I don't think it's a crystallized idea until the end of the What is Hecuba to He or He to Hecuba speech.
And it happens much later in the Simpsons version. and we'll get to that. I'll play a quick promo. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Simpsons Season 13, Episode 14, Tales from the Public Domain, the last bit, the last 7 minutes or so. So stick around, we'll be right back.
In late 1984, Marvel's direct sales manager said in a crowded meeting of comic retailers, "Let's be honest, Secret Wars was crap, right? But did it sell?" The room exploded with applause. Well, get ready for Secret Wars Series 2.
Beginning in 2018, Pulp to Pixels Marvel Superhero Secret Wars and Beyond will do the unthinkable, Secret Wars 2. We'll take a detailed look at the event, the tie-ins, the new characters, and we will attempt to answer one of the largest questions in the history of the Marvel Universe. What the heck was Jim Shooter thinking? No, seriously, what was Jim Shooter thinking? Well, you can find out at the Pulp to Pixel podcast network, where you can subscribe to all of our amazing shows, or just to Secret Wars and Beyond itself, as it is now in its own omnipotent feed. Secret Wars 2 and Beyond, a Pulp to Pixel podcast production.
You'll believe an omnipotent being can use the restroom.
Dad, these old stories can't compare with our modern super writers. Stephen Botchko could kick Shakespeare's ass.
Look, this story is more interesting than you think. It starts with Hamlet's father getting murdered.
Cool. Does he get to marry his mom?
I don't know, but that would be hot. Once upon a time, there was a young prince of Denmark.
Okay, we're back, and as promised, we're talking about an alternate Hamlet, one that I do not cover on the show normally, and I don't know how I would. It's so brief, it's so quick, but it's Tales from the Public Domain, Part 3, like the third act. It's a Hamlet spoof, a Hamlet parody from The Simpsons, Season 13, Episode 14. So you brought this to the show, and like you said, you loved it. It's only a third of an episode. It goes by really quickly. I want to hear what you think of just the idea that this play, normally, is all about delaying action. And then here we have to go through the plot points at an accelerated and slightly remixed rate. So how does it now play?
Yeah, I mean, that's the brilliance of this not even episode, third of an episode, is that they take the world's best work on procrastination, the longest, you know, overly long plays ever written, and they condense it down and they ask themselves the question, like, what is this story? At the end of the day, it's father dies, kid's told to get revenge, he's got to verify if it's true, and then he's got to act. And that's it, just boom, boom, boom. And I think the brevity of it, it is making fun of Hamlet in itself. Like, right, it's I mean, I can't tell you how many times when I was teaching Hamlet, we would get to act three or act four, and some kid would just throw their hands in the air and go, how is he still not killed Claudius? How is he still, like, what are, like, I got it in act two, but, like, it's been a long time. And so I do think there's such a tongue-in-cheek moment in The Simpsons of them saying, like, haha, we're going to subvert everything you know about Hamlet by boiling it down to these characteristics. And I love that about it. And then not only boiling the story down to its most basic form, but actually boiling the characters down to their most basic form while still keeping them Simpsons characters. Like, I think the characters are pretty true to the play.
They're one of the weird things for me. He doesn't get to marry his mom. There is a joke about it. You know, the Freudian aspect or mm-hmm. the Oedipal. It's an Oedipus joke, but we get it as scholars. But his sister plays his love interest, which they don't dwell on. But I'm always a little bit, oh, in Simpsons parodies, when there are so few, I guess, young female characters in Simpsons, that Lisa is forced to play sometimes what would be her brother's love interest.
Yeah, and in the episode, they don't have any romantic connection. And so for me, the highlight of the whole episode is Ophelia, because it's Lisa. You know, Bart plays the thing where I'll catch the conscience of the king, and Krusty does the exact reenactment of the murder of Camp Hamlet Sr., and Mo, who's Claudius, basically confesses in front of everybody. And Bart, who's Hamlet, runs over to the portrait of Homer and is like, Dad, you were telling the truth. Your ghost was telling the truth. He did kill you. Now I'll get revenge. And Lisa just goes, oh, great. Now Hamlet's acting crazy. Well, no one out crazies Ophelia. And you know, just nanny nanny, dances on the table, throws herself out the window into the river. And I love that so much, because that is a total Lisa Simpson moment. Lisa's the smartest person in the room, and yet no one ever, ever, ever acknowledges or respects her intellect. So no actual agency, no recognition for her actual qualities. They're very Ophelia. And then watching every man around her take on these big actions and these big decisions without consulting her, without thinking, without doing any sort of forethought. And she's like, oh, I'm out of here. Like, the only escape for Lisa Simpson from The Simpsons is madness. And so I think it's hilarious. And I also think it's funny, because she's actually feigning madness, where Bart is not. Bart is actually talking to a ghost. So I don't know that The Simpsons creators were going this deep, but I think they nail it with Ophelia. She's just there to be a pawn to these men. And Lisa's like, not doing it. I'm out of here. I like that a lot.
And Bart is playing kind of the Hamlet who doesn't really care.
Yeah.
There's none of that background where, you know, his mother married too soon. He doesn't care anything about that. You know, he laughs at the ghost, but he still goes, maybe I should do this anyway, you know, which is very Bart. It's also Hamlet 2000 in the sense that it's not, but it's in the sense that how do you represent youth in different eras? The sort of apathetic, doesn't take anything seriously. There is a generation where the youth, or there's an age where you're like that. So Bart sort of represents that, and that changes the nature of Hamlet. Just like Hamlet 2000, the sort of emo generation creates a Hamlet that is different from the Elizabethan ones, for example.
I always like to think that Ethan Hawke goes right from Reality Bites into Hamlet. He's the same character. He's Troy from Reality Bites, and then and it's the same guy. Oh, I do like the Bart as Hamlet part, though, because it's, you know, that when we first see him, he's in his bedroom, and he's got a sign that says, like, Danes do it melancholy, which is great. And then Homer's ghost is like, you know, your mother married your uncle. And Bart's like, yeah, that was a wild weekend. And they cut to a portrait of the two, of Gertrude and Claudius being married, and Bart, like, looking off to the side, sadly. So there are these funny little touches, you know, that are really great. And then I love the end when Marge, you know, who is Gertrude, Claudius and Bart have a sword fight, and Bart kills him. Ralph is Laertes, who kills himself, which is really funny. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern accidentally kill themselves, which is funny. And then, you know, Bart wins the day, slays Claudius, everything's going to be fine, but he slips on a pool of blood and dies, which is a great little meta commentary on how bloody that play is, and that, you know, no one's getting out unscathed. And then Marge, this is one of my favorite moments, just looks around and goes, I'm not cleaning this up, and kills herself. And that does feel very Gertrude, because there is a question, I think, at the end of the play about whether or not she chooses suicide. Like, you know, the Hamlet 2000 version, she very clearly chooses to die. But it's, you know, there's different ways you can read it. I love that moment because she chooses to die just going, oh, I'm not, no, I'm done with this stuff, done with this story. And there's just a funny sort of resignation to it that I think is present in Hamlet. And I also think as a reader of Hamlet and a viewer of Hamlet, you also feel a sort of resignation. While it's beautiful and brilliant and complex, it is also, like you said, long and ends on a really dour note. And so there is also a little bit of a feeling of like, oh, it's all going to end in blood. So I think it's super funny. And I loved watching my students every year kind of find funny stuff in it. I like when it, you know, poking fun at great works.
The deaths are all pretty clever, actually, because Laertes does die by his own sword.
Mm-hmm.
That also happens in the, you know, in the play, even though it's not in his hand. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, in this case, they have been poisoned. Like, the drapes have been poisoned. They've been painted with poison. The drapes have been painted with poison. The food has been poisoned. Everything's poisoned. And they high-five each other and die. So it's their own self-congratulation that kills them, which is, that's really their tragic flaw in the play. That's why they eventually die, is because they are so smug and believe in their own success. So that's also very clever, and I don't know if they did it on purpose, but...
Yeah, and the Simpsons writers are all brilliant. I mean, that show is just so... And then even Gertrude, in the play, her unwillingness to take a stand to clean up the mess she created, right? Like, her unwillingness to... You know, she acknowledges their o'er-hasty marriage, but she doesn't actually do anything. She doesn't actually help her son in any meaningful way and only really hurts him. I always think about, whenever I'm trying to evaluate who Gertrude is as a character, I always think about that scene where Laertes comes rushing back into the castle to kill Claudius. He's filled with rage because Polonius has died. You know, my father was murdered, and Gertrude jumps in between them and says, not by him. Almost, in fact, saying, like, by my son. And it's almost that final betrayal of Hamlet. And so I have trouble gauging her. So I like the fact that she dies from an unwillingness to take action.
It's her mess. Also, you know, it's like, it's a mess because it's her mess in the play. Claudius, also kind of clever, because his final line is, remember me as a peacemaker. And yeah, in the play, Claudius forges a peace. He thinks he forges a peace with Norway and with Fortinbras. And he's being foolish. He's, you know, he's not as good a statesman as he thinks he is. But that was his whole deal. Like, Hamlet Sr. was a warrior. I'm a peacemaker. Why can't you accept me as the rightful king, as like a better king than he was?
And it's supposed to be evocative of Nixon. Nixon's final line as president, you know, and so a shamed leader who was famous for taping people when they didn't know they were being taped. So I like, there's that Nixon patina to it too, which I think was, again, super brilliant.
And if we track back to the mousetrap, like I said earlier before the break, I mentioned that, yeah, Hamlet, you know, twigs on the plan really late.
Yeah.
Like, in this case, the play's on. There's already something going on stage. And that's where he goes, I could do this. So again, by scrunching up all the time in the play to this singular 7-minute point. And this is probably the part of the episode that I find the most illuminating about possible stagings.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have Krusty, who is a jester. So he's a still living Yorick.
Mm-hmm.
He's never called that, but that's what it is. And then, like, he says, well, okay, let's do a little bit of improv. Oh, God. So, so relatable. This is my world. But, you know, I need some suggestions. Usurper of the throne.
It's so funny. It's so good.
That's really the best part. And then it's like, you're poison. You know, yeah. Moe's going, eesh. So... So then they reenact the murder, just like the mousetrap does in the actual play, within the play. But here are the things that the thoughts that go through my mind in this particular staging because of Yorick's place in the actual play. So in the play, he's already dead. But the way that Hamlet talks about him, he is a sort of father figure. So we'll get to that when I get to those acts, obviously. But he is a sort of father figure where Hamlet Sr. is abroad fighting wars throughout Hamlet's childhood. Other people have to take on that role in his life. And the love he has for Yorick, who's just the babysitter, the nanny, essentially, that has an effect on his life. And when we think of, and we're seeing it here, when we think of Hamlet as someone who is super interested in plays, in theater, he's got opinions about it. He's, you know, when he went to Wittenberg at school, he also went to see plays, etc. He's friends with the players. Well, let's relate that back to Yorick, who is a performer, in the court. And that love of play acting, and then, of course, of play acting the madness, all may come from, like, his sense of humor may come from Yorick, right? So I'm, like, having a live Yorick on screen, even if it's crusty, now I'm thinking, okay, well, what was that childhood and how did it relate to later events, later attitudes, right?
Well, it's fascinating. I've hit on something really, really fascinating. I think there, you know, there, again, another meta statement. If Yorick was the father figure for Hamlet, you know, he raised him while his father was away. TV raised Bart. You know, like the Simpsons plop their kids
in
front of
him. And Krusty is his main TV star.
Exactly. And what does Bart watch? He watches Krusty and he learns lessons from Krusty and he itchy and scratchy. And he, you know, he kind of learns his internal lack of a moral compass from television. So in a way, you know, it does play really nicely because the figure that raised Hamlet is the figure that raised Bart in the episode. And then the Yorick piece is really fascinating, knowing more about that history, because there's a softness to Hamlet where, you know, there wasn't necessarily to Hamlet Senior, but that makes sense because Hamlet wasn't raised by Hamlet Senior. He was raised at the court. And yeah, you're right. That wit and that humor would seem to have come from Yorick, but also the value of the one who can tell the truth, like the person who can tell truth to power, because the jester has that role and has that ability. And so Hamlet would have also really respected maybe the only person who could speak truth to his father or his mother. The fact that the jester in the play, you know, Polonius really doesn't do that or can't do that makes him even more lowly in Hamlet's eyes. But then, you know, Hamlet really can't do it either. So yeah, it's really fascinating. Yorick, I would love a Yorick prequel.
But Hamlet does take on the role of the fool when he feigns madness. And because he's saying things that are true, and everybody goes, oh, how pregnant his, you know, his words are. So because he's playing the fool at that point, the fool has that role in, certainly in Elizabethan theater, certainly in Shakespeare's work, you have fools or mad characters who speak truth through a kind of heightened poetry. And that's what Hamlet aims to do. So I think Yorick is very much his example, you know, from youth. And I'm imagining here, like looking at this, is what if we staged a play where Yorick is still alive and he's the first player? So instead of having the players come in from outside, he's one and the same. I mean, there's probably something to be done there, and obviously it would require some rewriting, you know. One of the things that this version of Hamlet does not, like it doesn't have to be or not to be, or it doesn't have Bart holding up a skull. None of that, like, almost cliched iconography is in there.
Yeah, it ironically shies away from introspection and goes right to action. You know, it's again, just kind of on a meta level, really funny that it, you know, that it does that. And it also, I don't know the intention, but it also is a kind of an interesting commentary on, like, a 10-year-old Bart Simpson would hear from a ghost, try to verify it, and then take action. Like it's a childish sort of reaction, or, you know, Ralph fighting to his death because his dad tells him is a childish kind of reaction. Everything going on in the play is childish. And if people had just been mature enough to have some hard conversations, everybody wouldn't be dead at the end.
One of the Hamlets that you cover on the show is the classic Illustrated, the original one. And the original one was boys' own adventure type material. All the great works are sort of translated into what a 10-year-old might want to read. It is. That's what it is. So that classic Illustrated is very, very much not about the words. There's like 3-page spread when the ghost shows up, but then other scenes where normally we'd get like a soliloquy, we get one panel and somebody saying he's over there, you know? It's stuff like that. This is the child's eye view of a Shakespearean play where it's not, we don't understand the poetry really. We don't care about that sort of stuff. We just want to see it as a story. And obviously, with Shakespeare, it is about the poetry. You know, when you're really, really looking at it, the stories aren't necessarily as important as the words that surround them and how those words then relate elements of the plot together to sort of shimmer in a certain constellation. But, you know, most of the stories themselves are pretty simple, but then it's the emotional context that the words bring that actually bring it to life. The Simpsons are doing without that here as a parody element.
Which is also funny because in its early days, when with, you know, Bart Mania, The Simpsons was decried as the fall of modern civilization, right? Like the end of art and the heightened nature of lowbrow humor and disrespect, which is really ironic considering how actually brilliant The Simpsons is. And then over the course of time, The Simpsons is recognized as, you know, one of the great brilliant works, you know, the last 20 plus years, you know, and similar to Hamlet and theater in Shakespeare's days, where it was a low art, you know, considered by many people, and, you know, eventually becomes the thing that survives. And so there, you know, there's just a lot of fun ironies at play. And it shows Hamlet is so open to many interpretations that, you know, even The Simpsons doing it is smarter than it seems. And then you feel dumb for making it smarter than it seems, because then you're like, at the end of the day, they were going for laughs. Like, I was glad to have this be the recommendation, because I do think this is a funny kind of, you know, appetizer or amuse-bouche for people, you know, who are listening to the show and maybe are like me, diving into all those other versions that you're watching. It's a fun little cutaway and like, ah, you know, it's nice to get a quick laugh.
I think we can end on those words. So, Sean, thank you very much for doing this with me today, first of all.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I literally stalked you the minute you announced this, and because I have such a love for this work. And I just want to thank you, one, for doing this show and the amount of work you're putting into it, the amount of research and you know, into the play, but also into the films and the different versions of the films has really reignited my love for it. So I just really am so thankful for you for doing the show, and then letting me join is, you know, icing on the cake.
Thanks again. And well, how about you tell the folks where what you're working on right now, where they can find you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, which I guess is now X or Z or some sort of
symbol. Looks like a gentleman's club app.
It's so ridiculous. I'm still there in that dying space. And I'm also on Blue Sky, which a lot of our sort of niche comic book community is moving over to, which is fun. On both places, I'm Sean42AZ. And then I am occasional co-host of the Bat Pod, which is a podcast about Batman comics, occasional co-host of A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast, which is a comic book podcast. And then more frequently than you would expect, I'm a guest host on quite a few Fire and Water episodes. So in fact, I just was recording with Shag. So yeah, just thanks again for having me. And if you decide to have a guest again down the road, please keep my name in the hat, because I would love to come back to talk more.
I'd love to have you on this show or any other of my shows if the topic is right. All right, I'll let you slip back to the library while I play a promo. And when I return, I'll address some of the feedback the show's gotten. Stick around.
Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman. Johnny Quick.
Wildcat. Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Power
Seven
Man.
Soldiers of
Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire and Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Let's open the mailbag and read a few missives. On the Ronaldo episode, Ange said, "For some reason, Polonius is always a doddering fool. So hearing some snippets of this Ronaldo scene emphasizing Polonius as a schemer, as you've done before, has really been eye-opening. I also like how you bring up stunt casting as a way to somehow bulk up a role. For me, I think it's just friends asking friends to hang out on set. But Depardieu does add some weight to this small role." Brian Linton says, "During the hiatus between Acts 1 and Act 2, our daughter came to my wife and I out of the blue and asked if she could watch Hamlet. Apparently, she included a quote from the play in a short story she wrote. Realizing that she'd never read nor seen a Shakespeare play, she wanted to remedy that situation. Fortunately, we had a copy of Zeffirelli's Hamlet on hand, which she loved. While we watched, I had a chance to share some of the insights that I'd picked up from this show. So I wanted to thank you for the show and for helping foster my daughter's growing appreciation of Shakespeare's work through it." Oh, that's really great, Brian. Zeffirelli is one of my least favorite versions, but it was my first. So I do think it's very approachable. And on the fishmonger scene, Brian adds, "When we watched Zeffirelli's Hamlet with our daughter, this was the scene that I think really won her over. The physical comedy and the back and forth between Hamlet and Polonius, including the words, words, words line, had her laughing. Great stuff. Well, thanks for that, Brian. And I know she's moving on to Much Ado About Nothing. Great choice. So that's the end of our look at Act 2. Thanks again to my guest, Sean Ross. Next time, we take our first bite out of Act 3 with its first scene in which Claudius debriefs his agents. If you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and put keyboard to digital paper. And if you like this content, of course, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope, dear listener, you will return for Act 3, Scene 1, Briefings.
Rest is so.